We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Around we go, hey, playing hey, that game. Hey. Sell, move, use, be done. They want us to stay. Hey!
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Irreplaceable Truths. I'm Dr. G. I have a partner in crime now. Her name is Mallory Dickinson. She came to me 20 years ago as a veterinary assistant. I convinced her that it's time to get her license. So she's a licensed RVT. Lots of trials and tribulations to get there, but we got there.
We got there, finally.
She's there. And then she also was there when I started, I don't want to say my downfall, but my disappointment in the profession, which we've covered before. But it was, I was 32 years into it, so I was there for a long time. Like her, she figured her calling is to be more in front of the education and working with people who are interested in the profession and to make sure they stay in the profession.
Absolutely.
So she is planned a little fun thing today.
Yeah, so I know how much you enjoyed mentoring and how that is such a big part of what you want to do now is getting these early young career vets to stay in the game and how to be successful. So I thought, what better way to do it than to have one of your mentees show up here for us today? I did not tell you who it was.
No.
I'm going to make you guess who it is.
Okay.
We are going to do this based off of this person's pet names.
Are you kidding me?
No, not at all.
Okay, as long as there's not a fluffy, I guess we'll be okay.
No, I think you should be okay. So we're going to start with the harder ones, ones I don't anticipate you knowing.
Okay.
And then you'll get a freebie at the end. And if you can't guess it off that, I'm going to be really disappointed.
I am 52.
It's all right. All right. Okay. So the first one we're going to go with is a fish name. Okay. She has a fish named Bluey. Does that tell you anything?
A fish named Bluey.
A fish named Bluey.
Was it a goldfish?
You know, I didn't get details.
Okay. I have no idea.
All right, that doesn't give you anything. We have hamsters named Buttercup and Lucy.
Buttercup and Lucy?
Yes.
Were Buttercup and Lucy alive when they were with me?
No.
No.
All right. We have horses named Spark and Shelby.
Spark and Shelby. Horses.
Horses.
Did this person have horses when they were with me?
Yes.
Okay.
One of those was with her.
Okay.
You get two cat names named Squid and Hamachi.
Squid and Hamachi. Okay. I think I'm getting there.
Who are you thinking?
The horses limited it because not many of you guys had horses.
Right.
My associate had a horse.
Right.
In her wedding.
Yes.
You had a horse.
I did.
Bree had horses.
Yes, still does.
She had cats.
She did.
I didn't know her as a hamster person.
She had bunnies.
She had bunnies. That's how that our whole relationship started was with bunnies on that one. Who else had horses? Diane had horses.
Go deeper.
Like how many years back do I have to go?
Not that far. All okay. Right, here. Do you want the easy one?
Yeah.
This is the gimme game. If you can't guess off this one, we're done. Tater Tot.
Tater Tot.
Oh, come on. You should be disappointed in this. I know you're listening.
Oh, my gosh. How long ago does this person work for me?
What is a Tater Tot made out of?
Is it Morgan?
It's Morgan.
Morgan. Oh, my gosh. Morgan. All the way from St. Louis.
Hello.
Oh, my gosh.
It's good to see you.
Oh, my gosh. How's the weather in St. Louis right now?
Not
it's cold?
It's
Currently 5 degrees, feels like negative two.
Does it really?
Yeah, so I'm not going outside today.
Okay, so we picked a good day to do this.
Yes, so, we totally did.
Okay, so just so everyone knows, Morgan came to me as a veterinary assistant. She had a dire love of becoming and a passion to become a veterinarian like none other.
No, at such a young age, too. I mean, when you...
Right. Graduated from the University of Redlands. And I love this. I love to say this part. She's an Illini.
She is?
She is an Illini. And she was supposed to come back and work for me, but she fell in love with the Midwest. She did. I did. Wow. And then let's see. Okay, so let me keep going. So you started work, you did kind of an internship at an emergency clinic, correct?
It was not like a structured internship. I really just started working overnight shifts, ER, with some mentorship.
Some mentorship?
Yes. Some mentorship.
Minimal.
Not enough.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, my. And now, where are you at?
So I'm in St. Louis. I live downtown, and I'm practicing at Veterinary Emergency Group. We have a hospital just in one of the suburbs here, and we're going to be opening our second location here in the St. Louis market area, which is pretty exciting. So I'm still doing emergency medicine. That is kind of like where my passion has truly come to fruition.
Wow.
Which is why I did not come back. I really wanted to come back, but I was like so torn.
Well, I mean, torn between the cost of living in Southern California it all depends on what state you're practicing in, how fun this profession can be. St. Louis is a wonderful town.
I really like it. I'm a foodie, and we have really great food here. It's pivoted since like 2020 COVID era too. We have a lot more up and coming restaurants, so that is something I really love. Spending some free time trying out all the new restaurants, and like you said, cost of living here is completely 180 from Southern California.
So how is the veterinary job hunting out there? Are they short veterinarians in St. Louis?
We are definitely short. I can attest for emergency and specialty care services. We're kind of in like a weird niche market where there's just like not a lot of resources. So often, you know, let's say I'm working like a weekend shift in the ER and I have a patient that needs to go see a specialist or go get an advanced diagnostics. Our local specialty ER group, they're kind of like us on the weekends. They just do emergency care. So I'm booting those kiddos to like the universities, which are 2+ hours away. So it's a very weird market where actually like the last couple months, we're consistently one of like the top veg producing hospitals in the nation. Because we have such a high caseload because we're in this like weird desert of veterinary care.
Well, you said veg, so you're doing corporate. Have you always been corporate since you graduated?
No. So I started at a general practice emergency care center right out of vet school. And I did 2 years of overnights. Transitioned to kind of like a hybrid GP-ER for about a year. Ultimately, it was not the right fit for me. I was miserable, totally like hit that burnout. Like, I remember there was like one day at work, I like walked in and I just like broke down and I was like, I cannot do this anymore. I need to change. And that's when Veg was opening up in St. Louis. And I went into it with as open mind as I could be, because it's like a very different way of practicing. And truthfully, like I cannot imagine doing anything different right now. It has truly like changed my life. And I really love the people aspect. I love emergency care, surgery. So it's been a really nice fusion of all of those passions for sure.
Wow. So I'd love to dive in really quick. You said you hit the burnout. How long were you out of school? 2 years?
Okay, so I feel like there are often like the roller coaster stages, especially doing like when I was doing ER overnight during COVID, kind of crazy, right? I would say the point where I realized this is not sustainable and I need to pivot for my mental health was probably about 2.5 years in.
So 2.5 years, and then you're out now 4.5?
Yeah. So I've been at my new position almost 2 years now.
Are you feeling any of the same pressures, or are you having any of the same issues that you were having?
No. I'm like beyond happy. I have met such amazing people, mentors, the growth and learning opportunities, like dipping toes into like leadership and helping. Probably my favorite thing is we just started having new ER doctor graduates, which are fresh out of school vet students who come to VEG for like a 6-month intensive training program with mentorship. And so we just completed our first class in January. We've had them since July, and being by like new vet student, like I totally see why you had such like joy and fulfillment, like mentoring students all those years. I was like, I never knew that I would love this so much. It's so fulfilling to be able to like shape, you know, new young veterinarians, give them the support. So that's been like one of my favorite things. And it's really allowed me to see people as people. I think prior to that, I was very, you know, quick to judge, just like really, you know, negative headspace. And I now go to work. I've got a team. I've got friends there. You know, people are always going to be people, and sometimes they're silly, but there's just like a lot of self-growth I've been able to achieve in this new position. And I'm like, wow, I would have done things totally different in the past had I, you know, if I had the opportunity. But then again, like you always like learn things going through the thick of it.
Can we dive deep into what happened with your first job? What were you missing? What were you feeling? Just so the listeners can know, because, you know, I obviously the first 5 years are the most important. I mean, that's kind of where, you know, you get your professional identity. You get your where you want to, what you're going to do. You learn how to talk to clients. You learn the game is what I always tell people. What were you missing, or what was it that just was driving you towards the point where you're like, this is not the career for me?
At all about the last practice. There are a lot of individuals there that I think they were just doing the best they could. Truthfully, for me, what I recognized as being not sustainable for myself was I wanted more. I wanted more mentorship, guidance. I wanted more feedback. I wanted more opportunity and like surgical experience. Walking into work and having colleagues, you know, barely mumble hi back to you in the morning and just constantly having like a negative headspace, I realized it just wasn't an environment that I wanted to continue being in. I ultimately didn't feel supported, and I did not feel appreciated. I actually read, I remember reading the five, everybody knows like the five love languages, like the book. So they have the sequel to that. Like, I forget the title of it, but it's basically the five love languages, but words of appreciation, or just how you feel appreciated in the workplace. It's kind of like a sequel to that. And when I was going through this time of just like, conflict and not knowing which way I needed to go, A friend recommended this book, and I sat down and I was reading it in bed one night and going through all the different ways you can feel appreciated in the workplace. And something they talk about in that book is like missing the mark. Like you could be trying to, you know, provide your staff with gifts, but that's not what they really want to feel appreciated. And I really truly felt like they were just missing the mark. And I reflected back on, you know, 2.5-3 years at that point, and I didn't feel appreciated. I didn't feel like I was valued as a colleague or an associate. And I was like, this is silly. Why am I here? You know, we're not going to like tolerate toxic relationships like this. Why are we here? And I was like, we got to change. And that's when I found out Veg was coming to town. And yeah, the rest is history, I guess.
So your relationships you had with your mentees, it's more than just, and at least it was for me, it's more than just teaching them, right? You emotionally get involved with them. You learn about them. You get to know them. You get to know about their families. You get to know their strengths, their weaknesses, which is a very huge part of mentorship. Do you see, and that's why I think hopefully I gave you that shining light of what it takes to be a mentee or mentor. Because a lot of people are like, and I just had this discussion with Mallory this morning. Like they're going, oh, I'm going to go to this hospital that has 8 doctors because I want mentorship. That doesn't mean you're going to have 8 doctors that want to mentor you, because there also is a little bit of intimate relationship that's involved with the mentorship.
Right.
You got to feel comfortable. You have to be able to have that open dialogue. You have to realize as a mentee, if you get feedback, that doesn't mean the mentor hates you.
It's just a totally different relationship than it would be to have a relationship with a colleague, right? To have a mentor, to have someone that you can truly, in your case, you know, bounce ideas off of, run diagnostics past, you know, just follow up on your cases, right? But just someone that you can really just lean on in every way, right? I mean, emotionally, mentally, physically, it's yeah. A tough field in general, right? So to feel like you don't have support isn't great, you know?
Yeah, I was like crying out for support.
Yeah.
And that's something like as I'm now starting like mentorship and having mentees, I always want them to feel like if they need something from me, like I'm that person. And if not, we do have so many other great individuals that I'm working with that definitely would help provide that support.
How much of your new kind of refound love of veterinary medicine and practicing and being a mentor, do you think attributes to you having such amazing support staff behind you right now and you having these mentors and you kind of like seeing the other side of it, right? Like appreciating it more and being able to offer it now, since now you're kind of on the other side of it, right? And receiving so much more support on this end.
Yeah. Are you asking like with support staff, like,
yeah, like how much of it, like with your staff now, like, do you think really has just formed and made all this work for you, right? With having,
yeah, I mean, I feel truly from the top, like the tippy top of the company down to, you know, all my support staff that I walk into every day, I feel support from everybody. And that truly has allowed me to then be able to like break off and like do more and further exceed in the profession.
Be confident.
Yeah. I was very fortunate to, at the time of when our hospital opened, have an amazing medical director. Her name's Dr. Jenny Nazurka. She's kind of like bopped around to multiple veggies, and she's opening up a hospital in Kansas City. And she truly was like this like beacon of just like positivity. And there's a lot of like funny veg sayings that we you know, say to help instill like a positive mindset, giving people the benefit of the doubt, giving them grace. And she was just like such a prime example of positivity. And that really just like instilled in like all of us doctors, like taking on this new role and this new hospital and this like very busy location. I've got nurses and receptionists that just like model the way, and we hold each other accountable. for giving each other grace. And if there's ever like an issue that pops up, we're kind of encouraged to like talk about it with one another. But ultimately, I mean, when you're supported from the top down, I mean, the sky's the limit, right? Like,
absolutely.
Now I can go and mentor and take on new projects and do CE and just like further advance. Like, I got sent off to go do endoscopy training, like, opportunity that I didn't even know that I needed or wanted, truly.
Yeah.
So how is endoscopy? It's a lot of fun, isn't it?
Oh, I love it until it's a corn cob.
Oh, nice. Look at you.
Yeah. It gets stuck at the freaking, the lower esophageal sphincter, and I can't get it out most of the time. And then we often have to convert to gastrotomy. But they sent us to a very cool scope course in Vegas, and it was taught by internists. And they were just like very humble individuals. And one of the doctors, her name is, she called herself Dr. Tiny Hands. and we were kind of encouraged, if we were like young, small, petite women, to kind of like try like she does, because she uses her body to like move the scope. Mm-hmm. She taught us like this power star stance that I now do. And anyways, it was just like a really fun opportunity. So that just like, I was like, wow, I never knew scoping could be so much fun.
Did you have flashbacks to being at Canyon and scoping in the tiny surgery room? And
you know, I never got to participate in a scope.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
a lot of people don't understand.
Truthfully, I didn't even know you had a scope.
Yeah, scoping's easy. The biggest mistake a lot of people do is they try to steer the scope too soon. You don't really need to steer the scope. It's basically you just kind of just use your wrist and you turn.
Totally.
And, you know, and those were things that I did I don't want to say I was getting bored with the profession, but I wanted to challenge myself more. I would go learn a new skill.
Yeah.
And that's exactly, it sounds like what Morgan did. And there are not many people that are confident that aren't specialists that do endoscopy. Like, I love endoscopy. I think rhinoscopy is a waste of time because as soon as you go in the nose, it starts to bleed and you're done. Have you done any bronchoscopy yet?
No.
Okay, so there's something I need to teach you.
I don't know if our, it'd have to be a big dog with the equipment we have.
Mm. Oh, you don't have a pediatric?
We don't.
Okay.
Because one of the things we say is like, all we do is emergency, so that's what we do best. So if we start getting like other scope sizes and we're like, oh, we could scope the bronchus, you know, then it kind of like frays away from that a little bit.
If you have the toys, right, you might as well play with them. So then you start scoping everything, right?
Yeah, scope every kennel cough dog you have come in. So when you graduated, because you're still young and I'm not going to say juvenile. You're young in your career. how are the soft skills? How were learning those soft skills? Do you believe school prepared you for the soft skills?
Absolutely not. Yeah, that was one of the things. Truthfully, I like watched some of your videos with other doctors and just was kind of like getting a vibe for, you know, kind of this talk. And as some of the other doctors have said, like communication is absolutely like not taught in the veterinary school setting. I think there was maybe one elective during your fourth year that you could do, or one of the classes was like an elective, but I don't think that's enough. I mean, a lot of the soft skills, communication, supporting, you know, staff and your customers or your clients has truly been like a learn on the job trial and error.
Do you think you had a leg up being at a clinic prior to going into vet school and having so much experience that you already have had some client communication and you kind of knew what you were getting into, and you came in as an assistant, you know, pre-vet, and you were talking to clients about post-op instructions and, you know, getting them prepared, handing them estimates and having to go over, you know, why we want to do x-rays and ultrasound and blood work. Do you feel like that helped you
absolutely
in the long run?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think just like getting in practice of like talking to people is like step one. What I also really enjoyed was I enjoyed listening to other individuals talk to clients and kind of just like watch the body language, see what I liked being said, what I didn't like, you know, we should have said that a little different. So that I was like a sponge in that environment when I was, you know, shadowing and doing like a pre-vet school, like internship with you guys and like working as a tech, like all of those things definitely, I think, gave me a little bit of a leg up with the communication aspect. And then I went to vet school for 4 years and like, you know, you practice it to an extent when you're in clinics, but as far as like a formal, you know, class or, you know, practice doing it besides that, it didn't really exist. And I think it is a huge part of our job as veterinarians.
That's, you know, obviously my dissertation is dealing with the mentorship piece, dealing with how we're accepting students, which I believe we're accepting them incorrectly. We're accepting on IQ, not emotional intelligence. So any veterinary students or early career vets listening right now, what pointers would you give them to be prepared for day one or to learn that communication skill, especially if they only did that minimum 100 hours before they went to vet school?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing would be having a mentor, truly, because there are a lot of situations where if I have a customer or client who was unhappy or I felt like, hey, this just like didn't pan out the way I had it planned in my head, having somebody to kind of go through those scenarios and discuss the communication aspect is really important. Potentially, like if the mentor, you know, if you're hitting like a lot of roadblocks of just like, I'm just like not vibing with the clients very well or with staff, you know, maybe having that mentor kind of like shadow you and give you like in the moment feedback. I guess that would be like the best advice I have at the moment that I can think of, just because unfortunately, it's still one of those trial and error situations.
It's a game. You have to learn the game.
Yeah. And the clients can ruin your day. I mean, just as quickly as a case gone wrong can ruin your day, right? So,
yeah.
The way you approach them, the way you interact with them, it changes how they interact with you, right? And changes how they're feeling about you and maybe the cost of treatments or anything, right? Like you just never know what's going to set them off. But those soft skills they're hard to teach without the experience.
Yeah, I think for like soft skills, the most important thing is transparency. Like be transparent, be honest. And sometimes like honesty can be really hard. I remember I had a client that was upset because there was like a little bit of a discrepancy on like an initial estimate, and it totally, like at the end of the day, it was totally my fault. I like forgot and like accidentally added something extra, and I just sat down and I asked them, like, tell me your frustrations, like I hear we're frustrated, what is going on? And they told me, like, hey, you quoted me this and now you're telling me it's like an extra $200, like what up? And I was just really honest. I was like, I'm really sorry. Like, that's my fault. That's totally my bad, you know, and just like allowing that client to like say why they were upset, hear them, acknowledge like, hey, yeah, I totally made a little boo-boo. Let's fix that. Like, your pet is all I'm really concerned about right now. They were totally amenable after that. They care that, you know, their pet is being seen, they care that they're being heard. It's ultimately like big financial decisions with a lot of emotions. And especially as an ER doctor, I deal with that a lot. You know, almost every case. So it's being transparent, it's being honest. It's trying to find solutions. And sometimes just like giving them the benefit of the doubt, you know, and not making like snide comments to them.
Well, the cost of care is a huge piece, right? That definitely is not it. I mean, they make jokes about it in vet school, but they don't teach you how to deal with it. And every four-legged animal you see comes with a two-legged checkbook. And, you know, it's very important to just be open and honest up front. You always offer them the gold standard first, and you work from there. Because not every animal needs the gold standard. And the one thing I'm going to point out, what Morgan said, is that they were upset about $200. Yet, even though the animal was doing great, they were still upset about $200.
Right. Well, they feel misled just in general, right? So then it turns into the game of, well, what else are you hiding? Or what else are you going to surprise me with, right? They don't understand, right, that it's just a mistake. I think they forget sometimes that veterinarians are human. Yeah. And
yeah, clients are a big piece. I mean, clients are the number one reason for stress in veterinarians. It's not caseload. People are like, oh, it's the debt. It's not the debt. It's dealing with clients. And clients are, they're all over the place, especially nowadays. You know, you talk to people. I think, you know, I had Peter Weinstein on here, and he was talking about some lady at American Airlines in Chicago literally jumped the counter and started swinging at the gate agent.
Oh, good, good.
And and just people's behavior in general, you just watch how they treat people at the grocery store, like the cash register. I mean, this person's probably making $20 an hour, barely making it, and you're bitching about something that she has no control over,
right?
Or he has no control over. So I think it's very important. You just the open, transparent honesty will take you further than you faking your emotions and you
absolutely
and acting like you care. It's crazy. Now, I got some tough questions for you. If I look at you right now and I say, do you have that one case you'll never forget? Have you experienced that yet?
Oh yeah.
Was it outcome related or was it client related?
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the double whammy, right? So what happened with the client? I won't go into the case, and I really don't want you to relive it, but just let the listeners know what happened with the client.
Yeah. I mean, I think without like going into too many details, the gist is I will call them very dedicated clients that would do anything for their dog. And ultimately, this dog was one of the sickest dogs I've seen in my entire career, like about to code at any minute, and miraculously survived our visit at our hospital, ended up transferring him to a specialty center, and the dog unfortunately did not survive. And 6-7 months later, we get a letter for a lawsuit, and unfortunately I learned that there was some words likely said and written by another individual in the profession that probably catalyzed this. And so I had to go through my first lawsuit, which was not ideal. It just brings back, you know, imposter syndrome and just doubt in yourself. Like, is there anything different I could have done? Like, I have other people saying, like I should have done things differently, clearly to the client. And ultimately it's something I truly like, cause it's more recent. So it's still something that I deal with, like trying not to, as you said in one of your podcasts, like ruminate and worry, like can't do that. Got to break that cycle. So I've thankfully had an immense amount of support from like my boss and my mentor, you know, through Veg, going over that case, you know, talking with other specialty doctors about the case and learning that, hey, it's not a black and white case. you know, we don't find you, you know, negligent. You didn't do anything wrong here. It was like in the moment judgment. But that case will probably stick with me throughout like my entire career, because it was so impactful. You know, it's you feel like you do everything for a pet and their people, and sometimes it still doesn't work out the way you want it to, both case outcome wise and also like client outcome wise. And I was very disappointed, honestly, like with how it was handled. But
how was handled, you know, at the specialty clinic that you transferred them to? That's where I'm kind of,
yeah,
that's, you know, that's a problem. Is like veterinarians, we're not in this together. There are a lot of veterinarians that try to stab other veterinarians in the back, you know. And like when I would have a second opinion or a third opinion come in, you know, you can read through the chart and you could be like, what were they thinking? I don't, you know, wow, this is crazy. But the trick was, is that in my one of my mentors, Dr. John Hamill, always told me, what you say is, oh, we'll do things a little differently here. Let's approach this a little differently than they did in the past, because then you're not throwing anyone under the bus. You know, and until you get that horrendous phone call, that letter in the mail, no one really understands how hard that is. And it can destroy you. I mean, one of my associates got a letter from the state board because she refused to vaccinate a dog because she hadn't seen the dog in over a year. Yet they still went to the state board, and that destroyed her. And I was like, you have absolutely no problem. They're just going to throw this away.
Yeah.
But it still sits there. And I bet she still thinks about it till today.
I guarantee she does.
Yeah. Well, clients are hard. Clients are not, and you know, and you, the second you realize that you're not going to make everyone happy, your career will change.
But I think something that you've always said, or that kind of always stuck with me, was that, you know, we're practicing medicine, right? Like, it isn't perfected, not kind of to what you said, not everything is black and white, not everything, you know, are you going to take an x-ray and see that double bubble and go, oh, that's bloat. You know, you're not going to have obvious fractures every single time. Your blood work's not always going to be typical, right? So I think people forget that. I think they think that they walk into a vet's office and you can immediately tell what's wrong. And not only are clients or patients, our clients are very verbal, our patients are nonverbal, it's sometimes hard to get to the bottom of the case. And I think people really just forget that it's practicing medicine for a reason, right? Nobody has it perfected.
Just like practicing.
We've got to support ourselves. Like in this profession, we've got to support other veterinarians, give them the benefit of the doubt, give them grace. Like you said, G, you know, oh, that's, you know, we might do things a little different here. Like you should never be bad talking or saying like, oh, that's odd, or why do they do that? You know, like you did not see the case in front of you 5 days ago. You know, like there's so much that can change. We, like, as a profession, need to have each other's backs. And unfortunately, this was just my first experience of like it not happening. But it's definitely very important, especially for new grads coming out, to feel like they're supported.
Okay, so I was a new grad, and I was lucky. One of my guests, Dr. George Kacharian, taught me how to do an FHO. So a dog came in with leg perthes. You could tell from the x-ray. It was perfect. So it was so painful. And I knew it had a luxation patella as well, but it was so painful. I'm like, we got to remove it. You want to go to specialty? At that time, it was only like $3,500, $4,000. We charged, I don't know, probably $800, $900.
But there weren't a ton of, I mean, we're lucky we're in Southern California. We have a good amount of specialty. But even at that time, there wasn't a ton of specialty practices around.
So I did the FHO, and the dog did just fine. But then it started limping. Well, why did it start limping after the FHO? Because of the luxation patella.
Right.
And the surgeon called me and yelled at me because I didn't get a second opinion on the bone biopsy to make sure it was leg perthes. if I have a board certified veterinary pathologist that has more letters at the end of their name than I ever will, I'm not going to question. If they say it's Legperthes, it's Legperthes. But they told the client that I didn't ask for a second opinion. And the client wanted their money back. Yeah. And I'm like, and I was also at that point in my career where I'm like, fine, yeah, take your money. I don't really care. Because we were so busy. But then Dr. Hamill was like, no, we're not giving them the money back. And he actually called that veterinarian and read her the Riot Act. So, I mean, the thing is, as long as you have somebody that has your back that will step up for you, I think you'll be good. I think, yeah. And I'm so happy to hear that Morgan has that. Another question I really have for you is, if there is anything you could do differently in the first couple years of, practicing, what would it be?
It would have been taking a position that had more. I'm a structured gal. I like structure. I needed more structured mentorship. I needed somebody with me, like paired practice shifts, even like having a doctor there throughout your shift. Like, that is something I would have done differently for sure.
How soon did they leave you by yourself after you graduated?
Like a month.
Oh my gosh. Oh. That's terrifying.
So you're in an emergency clinic overnight.
I would have somebody with me there until about like 10 or 11 PM. And I always had the availability to call somebody. But physically there in the building from like 10 PM onward till 7 AM, I was by myself.
Of course, when everything crazy comes in, right? I'm sure.
Yeah. I made a lot of phone calls, I will say. I did have somebody that was there for me phone call wise, but it's now that I'm mentoring, you know, new grads, it's not the same as having somebody there in the flesh to help you through those moments and go through those cases. Yeah. So that's you why still we do had a career pivot.
Yeah. So do you still have the see one, do one, teach one method that I did?
Yes, we do. We do. Yep. We do that with a lot of our procedures, surgeries. We very much practice and embody that. It's fun.
Perfect. Yeah. See, that's another thing. It's just like, because like these new grads, they will get so nervous. And if something goes wrong, like there's nothing routine about a dog spay. Right. So let's talk a castration, right? If something goes wrong with one castration, in order to get a new grad, just try to do another one.
Right.
It's absolutely impossible because, like you said, Morgan, the imposter syndrome kicks in, the ruminations there, the worries there, the I'm going to mess this up is there. And it is very important to have someone, they don't need to be scrubbed in.
Right.
They just need to be in the room or in the other room or just within a shout's reach. To make sure that they'll be there to help you.
I mean, I've been there when we've had, you know, students who have gone to vet school and they come back and they work with us and they're sitting in surgery panicking, sometimes, most of the time, for very
minute reasons.
But I think they almost panic and start yelling because they know G is right there, right? They know our clinic is small in size. And that you don't have to yell very loud. But, I mean, Dr. Lysik specifically, I mean, I remember when she first got, she would just be like, bleeding, bleeding, and just start yelling, bleeding. And then you would go in and she'd be like, oh, I found it, you know. But she just kind of liked knowing that if she yelled loud enough, he would come, right? And that he could sit there and just make the situation better, whether we're making fun of her and laughing at her or truly supporting her and helping her through what she needs, right? But just that support, knowing that you can yell bleeding and someone is going to come help you.
Yep, absolutely. I'm like having flashbacks to a recent like Great Dane tail amputation situation at my hospital. I will say there was a lot of bleeding.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like, oh.
For that new ER doctor, you know, the fact that I'm 10 feet away and, you know, call me over at any point to help, you know, scrub into the procedure, was, you know, pivotal.
How much of that do you think plays into being new? You have all this training. You don't have a ton of experience in the field. And you start getting these cases and you're like, oh, my gosh, almost everything you know kind of goes out the window, right? And you, as a doctor, you know, not only imposter, but you're like, do I know what I'm doing? Do I know how to get this to stop bleeding? And, I mean, really, you're like, okay, let's just grab a tourniquet and a hemostat and
yeah,
let's kind of start totally. Going from there, right? But you forget those basic
Yeah, I think it's important things. To recognize when you are hitting your, like, fight or flight mode activation where you're, like, feeling yourself start to panic, because that is a good right. point, like a good time to pause. I've learned for myself, especially, you know, stat things coming in through the door, you have no idea what's going on, like just kind of having like a systematic approach in those moments. Like I usually pause. I'm doing like very slow breathing techniques. I gotten many times the compliment like, wow, you handled that situation very well. You looked very put together. On the inside, I'm dying. I'm screaming. I'm freaking out. But I'm just focusing on my breathing so it looks like I'm calm. I'm really not. And like in that moment, you know, surgery, like something's bleeding. Okay. Recognize it's bleeding. I need either pressure, I need a hemostat, I need cautery, or I need somebody else's hands are like the possible solutions there. In those cases, you know, we all have those cases that walk through the door where you're like, what the hell is going on with this case? Like, I'm so overwhelmed. I have no idea. Like, I usually step away to the doctor desk. I write down my problem list, like, what is going on with this patient? And then coming up with like differentials and like, okay, what diagnostics might be helpful for that? And just like, let's just pause and then go from there. You know, like it's, I think recognizing when you get yourself so amped up in certain situations, like to try to push through and continue on through that is not going to be beneficial. Like you got to step back, breathe, pause, find a routine that works for you to be able to like kind of move through those like panic inducing moments.
Do you believe emergency medicine's for everybody?
No.
What?
I don't.
What made you realize it was your calling?
I really love the cases. I love the mental challenge. Surgery. I love surgery. But at the same time, I was like, I don't think I want to be doing those like thoracotomies and like liver lobectomies and knee. Like I didn't just want to do surgery. I like having a case that is so critical and being able to like get them out the door. And so a lot of emergency medicine often is like immediate gratification, honestly, because
yeah.
I stabilize, I do my job and I pass it off, you know, or I take it to surgery and I fix her. I unblock the cat. I make the dog puke up the tampon. It just ate, you know, those are like immediate gratification things. And I'm in, I'm working on patients. I'm not the most patient individual. So I like having those like immediate wins. It gives me a boost. So
you don't want the 5-day hospitalized pancreatitis dog that's sitting on fluid.
No, the DKA with pink. That's like,
yeah.
You know,
the unregulated diabetic.
KCLC-RISE, like, I'll do it, but
yeah.
See, for me, I think emergency medicine, I loved it as well. Cause number one, you never really knew what was coming in the door. And number two, you didn't know what was going to happen with the case, because you're the last chance of them making it, right? You're the last chance of them making it. And if you weren't there, there's a good chance that animal wouldn't make it. Right. So if anything, I think it takes a lot of the stress off of you because you're just trying to stabilize. Like yeah. those people are coming to the emergency clinic. Like, I think my pet is dying. Right. Now, obviously you get your emergency ear infection.
Yeah.
And your emergency...
That'd be me bringing my dog in.
staph infection on the belly or the emergency hot spot. Yeah. But I think with emergency medicine, for me, that instant gratification was there, especially when you stabilize those critical cases. Like, it's like a, you give yourself a pat on the back. You kind of walk around, puff out your chest a little bit just for yourself.
I always felt like that after splenectomies. We would do blood transfer, you know, run blood, get in your catheters, start, get a bloodhound down there, pull blood, do your blood transfusion, get them in surgery, get that angry spleen out, and then they're like up eating dinner, and you're like, what? Like, what?
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Yeah. It was amazing. A little bit of GPER for that year, like transition, I was so much more stressed. I'm trying to manage like long-term cushionoid patients, diabetes, you know, why is the skin issues not resolving? And I was just like, man, I don't love this.
Emergency medicine,
like the chronicity part of it.
Yeah. Right.
Emergency medicine is a lot of fun. It really is fun. But it takes a special mindset. And the biggest thing is, like she said, you have to believe in yourself.
Yeah.
Because you are the only thing that's probably going to keep that animal alive.
Correct.
And where she's at. So there is something to be said about people who do have imposter syndrome. You need to put yourself into that situation, because as soon as you get a couple of those cases through, your life changes.
Yeah,
it really does. So that's awesome. Last question for you. If you were to tell someone graduating now, what do you, this is my three things I would tell you in order to get your head into the right space once you had a hard day, what would they be?
Probably my favorite like pearl of wisdom piece of advice is, at the end of the day, like as veterinarians, we are just the recommenders, and the pet owners are the deciders. That has alleviated so much anxiety and stress for cases. Often, you know, when you feel like I could have done so much more for that pet only if the owners had let me, or, you know, they declined all the things I wanted to do. You know, that was like really weighing on me. And so telling myself that phrase, I tell myself that phrase almost every shift, honestly, like getting through the shift and afterwards, like, I'm just the recommender. They're the decider. Like, it's their pet. I'm not responsible for their decision and therefore like that outcome, has been really helpful to like change my mindset. I wrote a couple things down. Hold on. I got to check my phone list.
I love that you came prepared.
Oh my goodness.
You know me.
I know. I expect nothing less.
It must be so hard to have OCD and do emergency medicine at the same time.
The struggle's real. Struggle's real for Morgan.
Okay. So like it's rare for your first job to be your last job, like in any profession, right? Like many people, like a lot of people go through multiple different job opportunities, career changes, pivots. And when I was going through that moment, I was talking with a friend and I was like, man, you know, I'm not sure. I feel like the grass is always greener, right? Like, is this opportunity really what I want to do? Is this best? And he looked at me, he said, sometimes working in the grass isn't greener, sometimes it's gold. And I was like, whoa, that was impactful. That was when I was kind of deciding between, you know, pivoting my career. And in my case, it truly was the gold, thankfully, you know, taking that risk. You know, obviously some opportunities always look shiny and nice, but may not be the case. But, you know, if you're ever in that position of feeling, you know, that your current situation's like not authentically you, you're stressed, you're miserable, you know, it's okay to change. It's okay to pivot. And even if that's not the right fit, you know, at least you tried to make things better. And maybe it's not that first pivot. Maybe it's, you know, several down the line. But keep striving for a community that makes you happy. That's all that really matters, is that you go to work, you've got a community that you feel supported in and that you feel happy to be around those individuals. So yeah, sometimes grass isn't green, it's gold.
That is very important because you spend more time with your coworkers than you do your significant others when you're deep into your career. You really do. And I think it's very important, and I love that you said that, because it you have to have that feeling of someone wanting you there in order for it to work. And I think you're blessed that you're able to find it on your second pivot, because that very rarely happens. And I think one of the biggest problems is, number one, a lot of these early career professionals don't give it enough time. Or number two, they give it way too much time.
Right.
Right. And if you have a gut instinct that you're like, hey, this is not working, you got to trust your gut instinct and try to find something else. And maybe there is a good chance that maybe practice is not for you, but there's still a lot of things you can do as a veterinarian for the profession that can help the profession immensely. I just love the fact that this sweet, innocent little girl that wouldn't even swear,
I know,
is now emergency medicine badass. I mean,
amazing.
Tough
amazing
woman doing this in St. Louis.
Yeah.
Halfway across the country from her family that means the world to her.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very excited to hear that worked out. And actually it almost chokes me up because I love seeing the employees I mentored.
Yeah.
Guess what? They're all still working.
Yeah. And she's kicking ass.
Yeah. And she's kicking ass.
Oh, I mean, I would like to think too, you know, she came not only, I mean, you have like Dr. Jima, such an amazing family, right? So, I mean, that obviously plays a part into your successes as well, right? Is that you have that backbone and support from your family. And I would like to think you were trained at a clinic or were raised in a clinic that loved you and supported
sure.
you and, you know, helped you see that you can't, you should be mentored. You should be helped. You should have people that you can lean on and call even from halfway across the country, you know, that you still have the support from like your original family, right? That you know what you deserve. So you've had really good examples set from you, whether it's from your families or from, I would like to think, Canyon, that you know what you deserve and you know what you expect out of a mentor and out of these relationships that you're going to be starting and expanding and continuing, you know, for hopefully the rest of your life. I mean,
you ever going to start your own practice?
I'll work for you.
I'm potentially dipping toes into more like leadership with like new ER graduates and stuff. But I don't think I won't say never, because I also said I would never work for veterinary emergency group because I thought that open con like everything was just like a crazy concept. But like, yeah, here I am, very Fine. Happy. So I won't say never, but I don't foresee it in the near future. Maybe, you know, down the line when I'm like, okay, I've puffed my chest enough with all these blocked cats, I'm ready to leave clinical practice. Maybe. I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But I feel very, very fortunate to have had the upbringing that I did, both with like my parents and just all that opportunity I had at Canyon, like with the other technicians, with the doctors, like that truly shaped me. And so I just want to thank you guys for always being there for me. And I know at any point I can like always like call anybody from Canyon, especially G and Mallory and Natalia. And just like G called me randomly like a year. I hadn't heard from him in like a year, and he just called me and we just like, you know, chatted. So I feel very fortunate to have those relationships.
Well, we love you and we are very, very proud of you. And I can't wait to see everything that unfolds for you.
My daughter's growing up.
His baby. Thank you for being our first surprise guest, too. He was really nervous.
I was nervous. This was amazing. I love seeing you. I love hearing your story. And now that it won't be a surprise, I'll probably have you on again, because I think the leadership piece is huge. I think the veterinary community lacks it. And the fact that they have a young, brilliant, wonderful veterinarian that wants to be part of leadership, that needs to be addressed. So
yeah, I'd love to come back.
Are you ever going to go back to Illinois and guest lecture?
I maybe with like an emergency talk through VEG or something. Cause I'm doing talks up at Mizzou Vet School, for VEG. I did like a cases night with the students, in November. So maybe, I don't think I was selected this year for, the Illinois campus. Also Squid decided to come say hi.
Oh my gosh.
This is wow. Squid.
Leave it to a veterinarian to have an overweight cat. Anyway.
He's just beloved.
Okay. Cool deal.
He looks fantastic.
I will let you go enjoy your wonderful day. Put on a lot of sunscreen in your January day in St. Louis. Morgan, it was so wonderful seeing you and talking to you.
Thank you, guys.
And I will have you on again very shortly. And actually, I need to talk to you because you're the perfect, another perfect person for my dissertation. So you will be hearing
perfect.
From me. Awesome.
Sounds good.
Okay, Morgan, we'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, around we go, playing the game.